This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Anti-immigrant fervor helped put Donald Trump in the White House. And on today's Your Call Media Roundtable, we'll focus on two recent news developments that affect the immigration debate here in the United States. In the first half hour, we'll discuss the presidential election in Guatemala of Alejandro Yamate, a right-wing former prison chief. Now, Guatemala has been the origin for many of the immigrants coming to the United States in recent years. And the current president's pact with Donald Trump to reduce immigration to the U.S. was a campaign issue for Yamate. And in the second half of the hour, we'll discuss a new Trump administration policy that would deny entry or green cards to legal immigrants based on their use of social services. Now, we're very pleased to be joined in this first half hour by Sandra Cuff, who is a freelance journalist based in Central America, where she covers human rights, social movements, militarization, and environmental issues. Welcome, Sandra.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad you can join us. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Arthur Delaney, a reporter with the Huffington Post, and from Texas, Obed Manuel for the Dallas Morning News. So, Sandra, we're going to open the phone lines in just about 15 minutes for questions for you. And for listeners, you can drop us a line at yourcall@klw.org now, or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So we want to engage our listeners in this conversation. But, Sandra, I wanted to start with you and ask, as we do every week on the Media Roundtable, to highlight good journalism and give kudos to reporters who have done a good job this week. So we wanted to ask you, what piece of journalism do you think was particularly well done this week?
Well, in terms of Guatemala, I mean, there's amazing work being done by an incredible breadth of publications, you know, both sort of the major papers, and there's a lot of really interesting and innovative and investigative sort of independent media going on in Guatemala. So, you know, within Guatemala and in Spanish, there's coverage of just a wide range of issues and news that don't get international attention. So I'd say recently one piece that stood out was a profile on Aldo Dávila, who will be the first gay man in Congress. He was elected in the general election in June, and has a very impressive track record as a former director of an LGBTQ organization that advocated, that still advocates for HIV-positive people's rights. And, you know, he just supports a wide range of human rights and social movement issues. So that's something that, you know, amid all of the maybe not so inspiring election coverage, that's one piece that really stood out for me.
All right. And for listeners who want to check out that piece, how should they access it?
That was done. There's actually a couple. So there was one done by Agencia Ocote. I could certainly send you the link if you can put it somewhere after the show. And there was another one done by a Wire reporter here. But if people looked up Aldo Dávila, D-A-V-I-L-A, probably gay Congress, they'll find some coverage of his successful campaign.
Great. Well, we'll definitely post that on our website first. So for listeners, please do check that out. And let's move on and talk about last weekend's presidential election of Alejandro Yamate, who, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is a right-wing politician and a former prison director. And he won the election with 58% of the vote, but turnout was pretty dismal. Only 42% of the country's over 8 million voters went to the polls. So how significant was this election?
Well, it's incredibly significant, but it's really important to understand sort of the context behind it. So this was a presidential runoff election. The general elections were held in June. In June, there was a field of 19 presidential candidates, and two of the three sort of most popular contenders were barred from running by the courts. And so, you know, Yamate was originally would have probably come in fourth, and he wouldn't have made the runoff. But because, you know, these two, the top three were women, so Sandra Torres went up against Yamate, but that's mostly because Thelma Aldana, who was a former attorney general and anti-corruption crusader, and seen as by many as sort of a beacon of hope in the elections, and also Suri Rios, who is the daughter of a former dictator who stood trial for genocide, was sort of probably polling in third, but both Rios and Aldana were barred, and sort of that's what led to Yamate's, you know, participation in the runoff. And it also led to the really low voter turnout, because a lot of people sort of across the political and ideological spectrum, you know, had their top candidates barred from running back in June. Many people were very dissatisfied with the two options that they had this past Sunday in the runoff.
So it sounds like corruption is a big issue, and you wrote about this in your article in the Washington Post covering the election. But you know, how did corruption play into this, and was that why these candidates were barred to allow Yamate to rise up to the top like this?
So corruption has been maybe even the top issue in Guatemalan politics for quite some years. There's a UN-backed International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala that has been alongside Guatemalan prosecutors taking on really high-profile cases. In 2015, the sitting president was forced to resign and was subsequently arrested. He and most of his administration are currently in prison. And, you know, there was an investigation into the current president, Jimmy Morales, for legal campaign financing in 2015. Sandra Torres, who went up against Yamate, is also under investigation and will likely be prosecuted as soon as the election process, you know, is officially declared closed for the same thing, legal campaign financing. Yamate stood trial for extrajudicial executions when he was a prison director. So corruption is a major issue, but in this case, both of the candidates who were up against each other in Sunday's runoff have had major, you know, allegations and sort of corruption and, you know, execution cases against them. So I wouldn't say that it really influenced the vote one way or the other, because both candidates, you know, are seen as being part of this systemic corruption that continues in Guatemala. You know, this administration shut down that UN-backed commission that has been tackling corruption in Guatemala. Its mandate is going to end on September 3rd. Yamate and Torres, neither of them campaigned on making a new agreement with the UN to bring CICIG back once they're in office.
They're removing some of the guardrails here, it sounds like, by ending this commission. Again, can you explain a little bit about why, you know, this corruption and human rights violations seem to be so endemic in Guatemala?
The UN-backed commission is actually not specific. It's often described as sort of an anti-graft body, but it's much more than that. So Guatemala had a 36-year civil war between largely rural leftist guerrillas and the army. State actors committed genocide. That was, you know, a finding of both truth commissions and of domestic courts here in Guatemala. And so the military controlled the country for decades, following a basically U.S.-backed coup in 1954. And so a lot of these corruption cases have really deep roots in military dictatorships and sort of, you know, U.S.-backed military rule during the Cold War. So even the case in 2015 that actually took down a sitting president and most of his administration, that network that he was a part of has explicit roots in the military that go back a really long time. So, systemic since military rule.
So definitely a deep history here, and I appreciate you giving us a walkthrough on that. It's just a snapshot. But let's try to dig in a little bit more to Yamate and who he is. Can you describe a bit about his background, some of his connections to some of the military elites in the country, some of his positions? And, you know, I suppose the other question is just who voted for him? Where does his support lie?
Sure. So Yamate, this was his fourth time running for president. It's the first time he made the runoff. He, you know, has run for different parties. Guatemalan sort of party politics is really complicated. Parties shift, they're canceled, new ones, you know, are formed all the time. So this is actually a new party, vamos. He was director of the prison system beginning in 2006. In that same year, during a raid in a prison. 7 inmates were killed, and 4 years later, he spent 10 months in pretrial detention, stood trial for extrajudicial executions, but was ultimately acquitted. He campaigned on, his main issue is job creation. He promises to create 2 million jobs in his 4-year term. No super clear details on how he's going to do that. That's all his main proposal for trying to combat, migration from Guatemala. But also really noteworthy are his security proposals, his security policies. So those include proposing to bring back the death penalty, treating gang members as terrorists, forced labor in prisons, etc. So his voters, there was a real sort of rural-urban split between these two candidates. So Yamate had the support, much greater support in the main cities in Guatemala, whereas Torres, and UNE have a really strong base in rural areas. Yamate also, it's a new party, but many members of other right-wing parties voted for Yamate in the runoff. It was more votes against Torres for many reasons, her policy, her history, being a woman, et cetera, than it was, really active support for Yamate.
And, this issue of the Guatemalan presidential election, it really directly affects, all of us here in the United States, to the extent that we've seen tens of thousands of asylum seekers and migrants coming here from countries like Guatemala. They're walking thousands of miles to reach the U.S. border, and they've, the reaction against that has helped put someone like Donald Trump in the White House and led to some of the rhetoric and violence that we've seen recently here in the U.S. And so my question for you is, in terms of the media coverage of this election, I mean, what have you been seeing, particularly here in the United States, that's good? What could be improved upon? What should journalists here in the United States be focusing on to really highlight the origins of this, the immigration crisis that we're facing here in the United States?
I admit I follow Guatemalan and Central American journalism more than I do U.S. journalism. But I think one really positive thing since last year is that more and more publications and reporters who cover immigration and who cover border issues have seen, I'm sure many have seen the importance but never had the resources to do so, but there are more and more journalists and publications coming down to Central America and really looking at the root causes in Central America and covering very, human-centered stories about migration. So I'd say that's definitely one positive thing I've been seeing just in general since last year.
And any responsibility you think that journalists have to expand on this narrative and connect the dots for people about the things like elections in Guatemala with the immigration surge we see here in the U.S.?
Definitely sometimes things are a little fragmented. I would say that sometimes it's largely just a product of, there isn't too much often context in international news coverage of Guatemala or many other countries. And so sometimes things are seen with a fairly narrow, especially in terms of time frame scope, just looking at these elections, current immigration, the Safe Third Country deal, and things like the UN-backed commission, without looking at the really sort of deep historical roots and the different sort of behind-the-scenes pacts that have been going on in Guatemalan politics and with the U.S., et cetera, over the past many years.
All right. Well, Sandra, I want to give our listeners a chance to ask you some questions. We've got you for just a little less than 10 minutes. So we're going to open the phone lines now. And for those of you who have questions for Sandra and want to join this conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or better yet, you can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We would love to hear from you. Again, that's 866-798-8255. talk. So, Sandra, while we see if any listeners want to call in with questions or email, I also wanted to ask you about Trump's recent pact with the current president of both Guatemala and Mexico to try to stop this humanitarian crisis, this flow of migrants that we've been seeing. And he pressured Guatemala in particular to sign a deal by threatening to punish Guatemala with punitive tariffs and a travel ban and taxes on the remittances that is in the case of Mexico, that come up to the United States. So was there a sense that Guatemala was essentially trying to do Trump's job for him by deploying all of these National Guard members to the southern border of Guatemala? This is in the case of Mexico, and in Yamate's now reneging or arguing that he's going to renege on this deal. What is the coverage like of that, and what is the sense of that deal that Trump cut and how things have played out in Guatemala?
Within Guatemala, I mean, it was a massive controversy. A vast majority of people are opposed to the Safe Third Country deal. It was probably a bigger issue here than actually the runoff election was, just because people found that so uninspiring in general. So the Constitutional Court, which is Guatemala's highest court, has, issued an injunction against the deal that Guatemala signed, and that nobody really knows the details of. And so it would have to have congressional approval here. I would clarify that Yamate has never openly said he will renege on the deal or, that he opposes the deal. He has expressed some criticism, has said he will seek to modify it. And he met with current President Morales the other day. Yamate's team is going to participate as observers in ongoing talks with the U.S. It's very unlikely that Yamate will back out or overturn the deal. Neither candidate promised to do so. And, during their campaign, obviously, this came up within 2 weeks of the elections. But it was sort of mild and somewhat couched criticism, with neither candidate promising to backtrack on the deal if they once in office.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that, and it's helpful to have your perspective on the ground in terms of how that's playing out in Guatemala. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Arturo calling in from San Francisco. Arturo, welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you. This question is directed directly to Sandra. There are several hundred thousand, according to accounts I've read, Guatemalan Indians, Mayan Indians for the most part, and they've broken down in different language groups, but they're here for a reason. They're here because they were ill-treated or they were simply denied opportunities in Guatemala, and they were denied those opportunities by the mestizo class, which I'll use in preference to just nominally calling them Guatemalans, mestizo being some different racial mixtures, mainly Spanish and local native. Anyway, I think Sandra probably gets the drift of my question. How does that work? How does it play itself out in Guatemala politics? Thanks.
All right, Sandra.
Right. Sure. So, I mean, yes, there are different estimates. The government lowballs it at under 40%. Many people state that 60% of Guatemala's population is indigenous. There are more than 20 Mayan languages. There's also Garifuna and Xinka people. So it's important to understand that even in the current sort of exodus that's going on, the areas of the country with the highest levels of migration are certain indigenous areas in the Western Highlands from the departments of Huehuetenango, San Marcos, Quiche. And so, yes, this is also something that has very deep roots. And so some of the main issues that were root causes of the 36-year civil war were, systemic discrimination, inequality, land concentration in the hands, of the powerful versus indigenous communities. So that's something that, despite the 1996 peace accords attempting to address some of those issues, those major root causes of the Civil War have never actually gone away. So, migration is overwhelmingly from certain areas of Guatemala, and they're majority indigenous. And these are really systemic issues that go back decades or
hundreds
of years.
Thank you. Thank you, Arturo, for that phone call. We appreciate you dialing in. And Sandra, I also wanted to ask, because I mentioned how Mexico is also part of this the deal that that Trump helped broker, or some say sort of coerce, Guatemala and Mexico into signing around the Safe Third Country Agreement. Now, how are relations going between Mexico and Guatemala? And can you describe a little bit about what it's like for an immigrant, humanitarian refugee coming out of Guatemala, going through Mexico? What are the relations between those countries, and how is that playing out in this debate?
Right, so that probably gets doesn't get very much attention, but you know, for many Central Americans, Mexico has long been sort of the first border. So it's not just suddenly now that you know one Mexican administration is going along with U.S. border and immigration policies. So you know, there are decades of Central Americans who have experienced, you know, militarization and all these kinds of issues heading up through Mexico, endangering them. At the same time, there is a, you know, there's a huge sector of the Mexican population that does support, you know, Central Americans and other migrants coming through Mexico. And there's, you know, massive, really inspiring sort of movements in different places to provide them shelter, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, for most Central Americans, the route through Mexico is just as dangerous as crossing the border into the U.S. in many places. So there are, you know, countless disappearances, murders, et cetera.
So definitely an issue that I think, as you said, could use more media attention in terms of what's happening with that Mexico-Guatemala relationship and the plight of these refugees through Mexico. And I also wanted to ask you just probably the last question, given the time we have remaining. How exactly do, you know, the average Guatemalans kind of look at the immigration debate happening in the U.S.? What's the sort of sense on the ground in Guatemala about U.S. immigration policies?
I mean, I would say that the perspective on the ground is more in terms of the Guatemalan government and its negotiations and deals with the U.S., as opposed to, you know, there being a really widespread debate about specifically U.S. politics. But like I mentioned, there's overwhelming opposition to the Safe Third Country deal for a variety of, you know, very good reasons. I think one poll here suggested that 86%, maybe definitely more than 80% of the population opposed the deal. So yes, it's a huge issue within Guatemala, but it's much more centered on the Guatemalan politics of this current deal with the U.S., for example.
All right, and Sandra, just last question, real quick. What's the next story we can look from you?
Oh, there'll be a bunch. Definitely probably one major issue is going to be the closure of the UN-backed, you know, Commission Against Impunity, which is going to be coming up on September 3rd. So among my next stories will probably some, you know, sort of different angles looking at what CICIG has been doing and the risks of its closure.
All right. Well, Sandra Cuff, freelance journalist based in Central America, covering human rights, social movements, militarization, and environmental issues. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
All right. And this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Call. We'll be back right after this break to talk about Trump's crackdown on legal immigrants here in the United States. So stand by for that just after this break. And now we're going to switch gears and talk about the latest assault on immigrants by this administration. Now, on Monday, Ken Cuccinelli, the acting head of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, announced a new rule targeting legal immigrants and visitors to the United States by expanding the government's authority to deny people's entry to the United States if they do not pass a wealth or education test. It also targets documented immigrants by denying permanent residency to legal immigrants or citizenship if they've been on social programs like food assistance, Medicaid, or housing vouchers. Now, to talk about the media coverage on today's Your Call Media Roundtable, we're joined by two guests. So I want to welcome Arthur Delaney, a reporter with the Huffington Post covering politics and the economy. And today he joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Arthur.
Thanks for having me.
And from Texas, we're joined by Obed Manuel. He is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News covering immigration and Latino issues. Welcome, Obed.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great. Glad to have you both on the show. And as I mentioned in my brief introduction, the so-called public charge rule has been getting a lot of attention, but it's been hardly mentioned that this latest crackdown on immigrants and visitors has been in the works for about a year now. BuzzFeed News has reported that it's been in the works since about last September, part of White House advisor Stephen Miller's push to reshape U.S. immigration policy. And they've been doing it bit by bit, you know, first with the Muslim ban, to putting asylum seekers in cages, family separation. And it seems like the media is acting as if this really just happened now. So, Arthur, I wanted to get your take on the media coverage on this and see if you agree with that sense.
I don't think the media was too taken by surprise on this one. We did expect it to come out in, you know, this week or last week. And it's something the administration has certainly telegraphed for a long time. There were drafts of new rules circulating, I believe, in 2017. And we knew from the fact that Stephen Miller had a position of authority in the administration that this was going to be a thing, because when he worked for Jeff Sessions, when Jeff Sessions was a senator from Alabama, they talked about this all the time, the nexus of immigrants and welfare. It was something that Jeff Sessions would rant about on the Senate floor almost daily.
And this was about legal immigration. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, talk about people coming to the country illegally, but in this case, we're focusing on illegal immigrants, right? Illegal immigrants.
That's an important point. This is all about legal immigrants and legal immigration. But I think that when it comes up in the news, the precision may be lost, especially because the president talks so much about illegal immigrants. I don't know how easy it is for people who aren't well versed in the topics to track these two separate things. And I think that's by design. I think they're happy for it to be actually about legal immigration. They don't care if to people watching TV, they don't distinguish between legal and illegal immigration. I think that's a strategy.
And Obed Manuel, let me ask you, what is your sense of the media coverage of this this new rule, and how should the media be covering it?
You know, I think like was said, I mean, this obviously didn't come as a surprise. You know, we covered it last year. There was sort of a leaked version right back last March that was much more expansive than this final version. Definitely stressing the fact that this is a shift away from how legal immigration benefits are granted. This is, you know, sometimes readers get upset when we sort of make a mention of the fact that the president has always stressed the fact that he wants to change legal immigration and limit it. But, you know, he made that clear last January when he put out sort of these sort of four pillars of his approach to legal immigration, which is basically merit-based, right? That's sort of the catchphrase, the key phrase that they use, because they want people who obviously are a bit more educated, maybe are a bit more affluent to be able to come here. And I think stressing the fact that this puts a lot of new barriers for low-income families around the world who are hopeful of a life in the U.S., that to me, I think, is a very important point to stress, because it definitely seems like a shift away from our history as a country, our foundation as an immigrant country, right? People who came here to make it, so to speak. Now, do people have to come already made, right? Already self-made? That's sort of the shift that I think we should be keeping an eye on.
And Obed, can you just describe for listeners what this new rule says exactly? It's supposed to go into effect in 60 days, correct?
Yeah, about 2 months from now. It's difficult to boil it down into 30 seconds. But, you know, for example, certain use of certain programs like SNAP, which is food stamps, some housing vouchers, certain forms of Medicaid, all of these for immigrants already in the country, right, that will be weighed against them. The big thing it does for people outside the country is the government now has the ability to deem people if they are likely at some point to become primarily dependent on these programs. So, you know, what if a USCIS officer, you know, trying to administer these benefits says, well, this person doesn't have this income, which is actually a factor right here. Income is a factor. If they say, oh, they're getting older, but you know, they make this much money now, and what happens if they lose their job at some point? So it creates this whole new discretion, so to speak, that could potentially, I mean, what's to say that they could, you know, they could basically say, oh, well, all this whole group of people will at some point likely become dependent, and then they could just deny those benefits. So that's sort of the thing to keep an eye on as well, is the fact that it really does reshape and gives this whole new sense of discretion to immigration officials.
And Arthur Delaney from the Huffington Post, I want to ask you, if you have the sense that there's a racial animus underlying some of these policies, is this just about fiscal conservatism, or is there something darker looming underneath here?
Oh, I think the racial animus has been very obvious. With Donald Trump, it's not even subtle. He calls it an invasion. He uses all kinds of nasty terms for immigrants, and that's really been his entire political strategy from when he first started running for president. And that's important because that will be a legal argument against that. I mean, that is in the complaints that have been filed against this regulation by states and by immigration advocacy groups, because you're not supposed to be able to do that. You know, that's contrary to our Constitution and laws. And there's really no doubt about it that this is how Trump operates. And it's a question of whether Republican judges will see it that way.
All right. Well, you know, one of the issues that has been missing, at least from my perspective in the media coverage, is more about the person who delivered this message. This is Ken Cuccinelli. He's an ultra-right-wing Tea Party hero. He was handpicked by Stephen Miller, the very, hawkish on immigration White House advisor. And he's also been a paid commentator on CNN. He ran and failed in a run for governor in Virginia. He's been very outspoken against immigrants. He even came out in the news about wanting to rewrite the poem on the base of the Statue of Liberty, to saying that we only want people who can stand on their two feet, you know, despite some of the immigration raids against working immigrants in this country. Obed, let me start with you on that question. I mean, can you talk about some of the media coverage or maybe lack thereof on Ken Cuccinelli and the need for more of a focus on who these people are?
Yeah, I think Cuccinelli is a really, really interesting character. He's in charge of, obviously, USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. I mean, this is the agency it's funded by the application payments, right, that immigrants pay, you know, immigrants in the country and those hoping to come here. So it is an immigrant fees-funded agency. He's in charge of this, right? And this is the agency that doles out benefits to immigrants. And lately, you know, just sort of based on his media appearances up until, like, this past Monday, he's been a lot more focused on ICE, which is obviously Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He's been very focused on removals of people from the country. And that's really interesting to see, especially given the fact that, he's in charge of this agency that for a long time has been seen as immigrant-friendly to a degree. I remember a while back, BuzzFeed reported that some USCIS employees were being asked to volunteer for ICE duties, like off hours, basically. And that, to me, it shows you sort of the mentality, I think. It's obviously difficult to assert or assume, but USCIS working with ICE, it's not a surprise, right? But at the same time, it's again, this agency that is supposedly immigrant-friendly, it's acting in a very different way now. There's growing backlogs, and you have to wonder at some point, you know, has the mentality at the top changed?
And Arthur Delaney, I wanted to give you an opportunity as well to weigh in on Ken Cuccinelli and the media coverage around him. What have you been seeing, and what do you think are important take-home points for people who are following this issue?
Well, there's been a debate about the Emma Lazarus poem on the Statue of Liberty that explicitly welcomes poor, wretched immigrants to the United States. And Ken Cuccinelli proposed on Monday, what it really means is we should welcome immigrants who can stand on their own two feet, which, of course, is contrary to the obvious meaning of the poem. And then on Tuesday, he was asked about having said that, and he said, well, the poem was, intended for people from Europe. And you really could not ask for a more explicit statement of preference for white immigrants and not immigrants from Latin America. And his background aside, there it is. It's perfectly clear the racial animus behind this decision. And and Ken Cuccinelli put it on a platter.
All right. Well, for those of you who are just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. And today is our media roundtable. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, of course, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're talking, we talked earlier about last weekend's presidential elections in Guatemala and the impacts of U.S. policy on that country. And now we are discussing some of the changes that the Trump administration is proposing to crack down on legal immigrants in this country. And we do want you to call to join in with the conversation. Again, that number 866-798-TALK. Or 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you and what your take is on these issues. What do you make of the media coverage of the immigration and humanitarian crisis at the border? What can reporters like our guests on the show today do to put the news of the day in perspective? And what kind of articles are you looking for to learn more about these issues? So please do call in 866-798-TALK. So, Arthur, you wrote in your recent piece in Huffington Post that this new regulation cracking down on legal immigrants in the U.S. is this, quote, centerpiece of both President Donald Trump's anti-immigrant agenda and his anti-welfare agenda. It shows how the two complement each other and how Trumpism is a political strategy that panders to white Americans. And you know, how has the media been really addressing this core issue? You know, it seems like we've had a long time in this country where the media really was reluctant to call out, you know, direct racial animus by candidates, and candidates, you know, maybe weren't quite as shameless as Donald Trump in engaging in some of this rhetoric. But where are we at in terms of the media coverage of the central issues animating the Trump campaign and his voters?
It's clear that the media now is more willing to call racist things racist instead of using a euphemism. I think it's probably not as aggressive in telling the truth as it could be, though I must admit I haven't taken a holistic review of how that works. But the welfare point is important because it shows how politics has hacked the media to avoid being avoid charges of racism. Welfare politics for the past several decades has used code words. That instead of referring to black people and disparaging groups of people directly, it'll be things like inner city and unwed mothers. And you know from surveys and from a lot of research that's been done academically that these are cues voters pick up on. They know, even though you didn't say you're talking about black people, that that's what you mean. And I think that's why it's important to note that the Trump administration is doing a lot of stuff on welfare, sort of in the background, because it gets less attention than his tweets. And now this immigration story has come roaring onto the picture, and it's colliding with the welfare. And with immigration, the rhetoric is actually more brazen from Trump. I mean, he just says immigrants from Mexico are rapists and they're murderers. It's not the kind of coded language, but you do find that he has both strategies. There's the welfare agenda that does use that more subtle talk, and the anti-immigrant language that's incredibly brazen.
And Obed Manuel from the Dallas Morning News, what's your view on this? What's the sense in Texas and in Dallas in terms of the president's use of racism, basically to advance some of his issues and advance the sort of get the his base riled up in this way?
You know, we've heard for a long time. I mean, since 2015, since even before I started here at the newspaper, covering the sort of one of the president's visits to Dallas. And there's just, you know, we hear it on the ground. We hear people feel attacked, obviously, primarily Mexican immigrants. But now, obviously, the president has used language about, immigrants from other countries. There's just a sense that the federal government, that the agencies, right, are not friendly right now, and that's definitely the sense I get, obviously, from talking to people on the ground, from talking to advocacy groups, from talking to immigration attorneys. It definitely feels like the people feel hostility right now coming from leadership, and obviously what we saw in El Paso is a lot of people have linked it to this sort of attitude, this sort of hostility. Whether it's my place to say as a reporter or not, right? That's up for debate. But at the same time, as a Hispanic immigrant myself, I've said it openly to my editors. Some of the rhetoric makes me uncomfortable, and that's not up for debate. That's not an opinion, right? It's just a fact. It does make me uncomfortable, and it's making a lot of people uncomfortable.
And I'm glad you're saying that. I think that's important for people to understand. Certainly to know that that we have a journalists who are aware of the dynamic that's being created and feeling it personally. So thank you for sharing that with listeners. And let's go to the phone lines. We have Kathleen in San Francisco. Kathleen, welcome to your call.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to bring up, and I also think that it isn't mentioned enough by journalists, is that we are facing, as the United Nations has predicted, massive exoduses because of climate change and the desperation that's going to arise out of droughts, lack of food, all of the things, the rising seas and everything else. Massive exoduses of desperate people from a lot of countries, and that it's going to impact the whole situation, I mean, in a way that we have never, ever seen, of course, and how at least we perhaps have a discussion of how to deal with it. I mean, what is going to happen? These people will be in numbers that we've never seen or could even imagine, and it's going to happen. It's already starting to happen for those reasons, aside from poverty and violence and all the reasons that already exist. I don't hear people talking about that enough because it's going to be a major crisis.
Yeah, so Kathleen, thank you for bringing up this issue. It's really critical thinking about climate change and how it affects these issues. Obed, Manuel, let me direct that question first to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think we've seen, I remember one of my colleagues reported on a story. He traveled down to Alfredo Cochado, he traveled down to Guatemala, and that definitely has come up. And I think, as the conversation about climate change evolves and comes to include, it's something that a lot, again, I've heard from a lot of advocacy groups, is we're going to have to start considering the fact that people are going to be displaced due to rising sort of sea levels, and where are these people going to go, which again, as a journalist, I have to ask that question. What's going to happen with them, and where are they going to go, and where are the only places that they can go? And again, at least in Guatemala, one my colleague found that that is a potential reason why people are leaving certain areas of the country.
And Arthur Delaney, do you want to weigh in on climate change and how that affects this immigration debate?
Well, I don't think that climate change will bring a single precipitating event where everyone says, "Oh, look, it's climate change causing all these new problems." It'll be something that causes more discrete problems that are similar to what's already gone. Things will just get worse. It definitely doesn't help, and I agree with the caller that maybe it deserves more attention.
All right. Well, thank you, Kathleen, for dialing in with that. And I wanted to return to this proposed rule here from the Trump administration. And, as we talked about at the beginning of the segment, it affects legal immigrants, not those who have come to this country illegally. And, one of the roles that I think journalism can play is really bringing the human side of this to bear. And can you, and I'll start with Obed on this one. Can you kind of paint a picture of that the legal immigrant that might be, sort of unfairly targeted by this policy? And I say unfairly and not to put a value judgment on it, but someone who really sort of can elicit sympathy from those who may not be familiar with someone in this position who would be affected by this rule. Like, how do we sort of personalize the impacts of this rule? So, Obed, starting with you on that.
I think the sort of classic archetype, immigrant, maybe at the start of the century it was, or the last century, it was white immigrants. Nowadays, obviously, it's mostly people of color who are trying to come to the U.S. Imagine, a father or mother who are trying to bring their family to the U.S. to start over, to make a living, maybe not even middle class, but if they're not making enough money in their own country, if they don't have enough assets to build up enough wealth, so to speak. For example, a family of four would have to make about $63,000 to have that be weighed in their favor. So, and that's the average income in the U.S. is about $57,000, according to U.S. Census data. So it's not, it doesn't seem feasible. I mean, if somebody has the American dream, it definitely seems like it's out of, these rules put it out of reach for them. And that's people who, again, sort of the classic immigrant phrase is, you know, coming here to work. That these are the kind of people who will likely be affected most directly by this new rule.
And Arthur, I wanted to ask you this similar question around the sort of myth-busting role that the media can play. Like, for example, with food stamps, I think it's plurality or majority white Americans who are on food stamps. Is that right?
That's right. It's a plurality. But when you just get all these headlines that have the words immigrants and food stamps in them, I think that creates a strong impression and reinforces one that's been built up over time, that those programs are not plurality or majority white, that they're mainly for people of color, which is not true. But to bring it home, I think that these are people who are performing core functions in the economy. Like, it could be agricultural workers who are here on visas that want to either extend their stays or maybe apply for legal permanent residency, who will be subject to this rule or might not be, but mistakenly think they are, and say, withdraw or tell family members not to apply for benefits that they actually would be legally entitled to. So it creates a climate where people are afraid to interact with the government and basically makes it more likely they'll have just a more material hardship.
It creates a real perception of fear and a sort of a chilling effect. So I think that's an important dynamic to cite. Let's go to the phone lines. Sandra from San Francisco is calling in. Sandra, welcome to your call.
Yes, hi. In listening to this conversation over immigration, not just yours, but in the country, I was wondering why no one is talking about the Cuban immigration that happened in the early 60s after Castro came in to Cuba. We welcomed, at that point, about 250,000 Cubans into the United States and supported them for, I don't know, some for several years. Now, I have no problem with this, but I don't know why this is not mentioned. And I understand why it happened, because of Castro, etc. But there was no talk about this, and now we're talking about an invasion. I know it's a lot of people coming into this country. I have no problem with it. I think it's terrific that we should help the people coming from Central America and Mexico. But these people were coming also from Central America, and at that point, we said, welcome, come in, right. No problem.
Well, Sandra, I think it's an important historical point. You know, we have welcomed immigrants from Latino countries like from Cuba before. Arthur Delaney, do you want to respond to that? Why we're in a different political rhetoric and attitudes about the immigration now than before?
Well, with Cuba, it was a special case. I'm not an expert on this, but I believe that this involved the Cold War, and our government welcomed a lot of Cubans as part of that proxy battle with the Soviet Union, and they were granted special status for political reasons, and they were fleeing tyranny. It wasn't as economic necessarily as it is with the migrants who are coming to the U.S. from Central and South America. And another factor with Cuban Americans is that a lot of them vote Republican, as it is right now.
And we certainly saw that in Florida in the 2000 election. That was a real sort of tie-breaking demographic. Well, thank you, Sandra, for calling in with that question. We just have a little over a minute left. And, Obed, I wanted to start with you on this final question, which is what other stories are you working on, or do you think need to be brought to attention to help people understand the changes that are happening with our legal immigration system and the Trump administration?
I think this is going to be the big one. I think this public charge situation might be a really big one for a while. I know definitely here on the ground, a lot of groups are concerned that parents are going to pull their children off of public programs. We're sort of waiting on some numbers from a local organization on sort of the effect that they might be seeing already. And so that's definitely something to keep an eye on, because at this point, that's going to be a public health issue for U.S.-born children of immigrants. So that's something I'll be keeping an eye on here locally.
All right, we look forward to reading stories from you on that, Obed. And Arthur, same question to you. What stories are you working on, or do you think need to be brought to attention for people?
Oh, I agree that the public charge story will be huge going forward. It'll be a question of how long it can, if it goes into effect, and how long it can stay there, because there's already litigation, and there could be a preliminary injunction that stops it from happening, and then it could wind up at the Supreme Court. And how loyal are Trump judges?
All right, so we'll have to keep following the story. It sounds like it's not quite a final deal yet if this is going to be litigated. So Arthur Delaney, reporter with the Huffington Post, covering politics and the economy, joining us from Washington, D.C. today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to also thank Obed Manuel, coming to us from Texas, where he's a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, covering immigration and Latino issues. Thank you so much, Obed, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's an important conversation.
All right, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in today, and apologies for not being able to get to all of your calls on the show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. We'd love to hear your take on the show. And you can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. And, of course, email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Have a great weekend. It's Your Call.